listening to the Stumptown Trade Review. I'm Thor.
I'm Brian.
And today we are going to be reviewing I Kill Giants, written by Joe Kelly and art by J.M. Ken Miyamura, and Resurrection by Mark Guggenheim, David Dumhier, and Douglas Dabbs. And I think that we are going to start with I Kill Giants first.
Sounds good to me.
So, I Kill Giants, and we're going to really try not to spoil this plot, because I think that this is one of the best books that's come out this year, if not the best so far. And it's got a great twist to it that kind of is the focus of the whole book, and I don't want to spoil that. So we're going to really try not to.
Right, we're going to talk around, I mean, there are some points that we can get into that are important to hit on, but I think that, yeah, the ending is not going to be revealed in this. This is one that's worth, I mean, I think I'll spoil it for you right now. This is one that we're going to say is worth going and picking up.
Yeah, definitely. If you haven't picked this up yet, I feel like this is really the best book that has come out this year, and it's a must-own for sure for any comic book fan. So that being said, this is a book that's about a girl in fifth grade. Who believes that she can kill giants and kind of has a mystical world built up around her. And we don't know whether that's true or not. We see kind of, I don't know whether they're hallucinations or whether they're real. That's kind of what you're trying to decide throughout this book. Mm-hmm. And really, it's set up well through the writing, because she's in one of the very first scenes, she's playing D&D with her friends. And so there's a heavy fantasy element in her life and in her play. So you're not sure whether they're real or not, and that's kind of like the focus of this book.
Right. And I think you nailed it right there, is that is the focus, that there is a real blurred line between the fantasy and reality here, and it's up to the reader to sort out for themselves, because there are many parts of this book where it's never revealed what's real and what isn't. Mm-hmm. What's going on in the head and the imagination of the person, if all of it is or if none of it is, mm-hmm. going on, and then it's all reality. It's never really revealed. And that kind of, ambiguity comes out not just in the writing, but in the art as well. One of the great pieces of this is the character design.
Yeah, definitely.
The character design of the main character, Barbara, is inspired. She is, she looks like a fifth grade girl. She's long and gangly, and she's clearly just hit that puberty age where, she's all arms and legs. And she has a very distinct feature about her, and that is her headband, if you will. She has, at times, ears. They look like rabbit ears that stick straight up from her head. Sometimes they're more conical, like bull horns. And we're never sure if they are real. Like, we're living in a sort of some weird fantasy world where it's just, kind of an anthropomorphical thing.
Yeah, like manga-esque.
Yeah, if it's actually a headband and a hat with, like you said, manga, with the girls that walk around with the little cat ears on their hats. And it's never clear, and that's what's so brilliant about it.
And you'll see pictures of her where she's sitting on a park bench, and she's in, full plate mail. And then you see, little fairies dancing around her, talking with her. And so you're never sure, what exactly is real and what isn't.
Right. And that's the thing, is that it really doesn't matter if these characters that she interacts with are real or not. I think there's two kinds of antagonists in their story. There's the antagonists that are in her day-to-day, everyday life that are very real to any person who's ever gone to school. I mean, the bullies and the teachers who think they get it but really have no clue what's going on. And then there's Barbara's fantasy world antagonist that is ruled by giants, hence the name of the title. Giants, and then above the giants, there's actually titans. Mm-hmm. And I'm not sure that it really matters if any of those giants or titans are real or not. Just like it doesn't matter if the ears and horns are real or not. This story works as an allegory, and it works as a straightforward story. Her sitting there on the park bench in full armor, it doesn't matter if that's real or not, because, I mean, how many times as a kid did you feel, you know, sitting there waiting at the bus stop, like you were just, you know, doing everything you could to put up as many layers of protection between yourself and all the people you are going to have to come in contact with.
Sure, and especially this character that faces daily antagonists, you know. She has a regular bully that picks on her, and so she definitely, I would see, feels a need for that protection. And I've got to say that the writing in this book is some of the best that I've come across in comic books. For a writer to have me empathize with children is really a task. Like, I don't do it very often. The last time that I empathized with a child like this really was probably Cowboy Bebop with Ed, in that I just don't really get children and I don't really like them usually. And I totally loved Barbara. Like, Barbara was one of the coolest characters and protagonists that I've ever read about.
Well, and the fact that a grown man nailed a fifth grade girl's voice and experience so well, you know, it just goes to show how well this is written. I mean, he made her life so painful.
You really get behind this character right from the very first page. You know, you get behind her and you're stoked for her and you really are rooting for this character to succeed.
Oh yeah, I mean, you are sold on her from page about five. There's this brilliant splash page where she, it's a little bit later than that, maybe 10, brilliant splash page where she just stands up in front of her class and announces, "I kill giants." And from that moment on, you are just behind her all the way, and you are rooting for her and you want her to succeed. And when she fails miserably, as kids do, you're there feeling for her. There's none of that, "Oh, well, you know, she's just a kid." It's, I mean, it's heartbreaking as a reader to do that.
And she has a really smart, witty voice, you know. She takes her bullies and cuts them down, you know, using her intellect and her wit. And it was just such a great character. Like, I just absolutely love Barbara. And for me to, like, get behind a little girl is just amazing that Joe Kelly was able to do this.
Yeah, and well, and I think I should point out really quick that Joe Kelly and Man of Action Studios are the people that produced the Ben 10 TV series, which is, you know, as far as your Saturday morning cartoon fare, it's actually better than, you know, a lot of stuff that's out there. Again, it's smartly written. It's written with a real kid's voice in mind. And so when I saw that this was a Man of Action, you know, this had Man of Action stamped on it, I was, you know, I was excited that, okay, he'll probably get, you know, the kind of the kid element to it. But the fact that he just nailed the character so well and what it's like to be at this particular age, then that was just, he hit that one out of the park.
Yeah.
And, you know, pacing-wise, you know, this was released as individual issues. And I really felt like this read so well as a collection. I didn't feel like we hit the 22-page, you know, cliffhanger, then pick it up, 22 pages, then cliffhanger. This was paced through like it was written to be a long form book.
Yeah, definitely. And just the individual like panel pacing from panel to panel was just flawless. Like, there's funny moments in here that just hit. There's sad moments in here that just kill you. And there's, you know, inspiring moments that you're just super excited for Barbara, you know, to slay that giant or whatever it is that she's doing, you know, or just cut down that bully. And right. There's just, everything is just absolutely nailed. The pacing was flawless in this.
Yeah, I enjoyed it. I didn't feel like it was over too soon. I didn't feel like it drug on anywhere. I really felt like this was, I think it ended up being 7 issues. And I can't see how it would have been 6. I can't see how it would have been 8. I mean, I really think that this was the right amount of time on here. And it allowed for the quiet moments as well.
Mm-hmm.
It allowed us to understand why it is that Barbara doesn't feel like there's any safe place for her. Most kids have the option of having a room or a house or a friend's house or something that's safe. And Barbara really doesn't have any of that.
Yeah.
She has something absolutely terrifying to her in her own home that is represented in the story as almost a phantasm. I mean, just this, yeah, this disembodied, haunting voice coming from up this creaky set of stairs. You know, she has really no friends until Sophia shows up.
Yeah.
And even then, you know, Barbara just doesn't know how to handle friends. She's never really had, yeah, any. She has the group of people she plays Dungeons and Dragons with, but that didn't even really seem like it was a terribly, you know, effective friendship, yeah, there.
It seemed like it was really a family dynamic. Like, it was her brother, and it seemed like her brother's friend,
right,
maybe, that they were playing. But another thing that he hits really well is she really actively tries to reject these friendships, you know, before she gets rejected. Like, her counselor, Mrs. Mole, you see throughout the course of the story, is really on her side and trying to, you know, cope with her and help her.
Mm-hmm.
But from Barbara's point of view, you know, she's just another outsider that she doesn't want to let inside. And a lot of times when you see in these books with the protagonist rejecting those characters, you just feel like, come on, you know, what are you doing? But this was done so well that you really empathized and saw it from Barbara's point of view, and you were like, you could see why she was over and over rejecting and, you know, keeping her arm's length from these people.
And again, it comes back to that voice.
Mm-hmm.
Because she says everything that anybody ever wanted to say. You,
yeah,
know, the whole part where she gets called to meet Mrs. Mole for the first time. And it's literally a call. A person stands in the lunchroom and yells, Barbara, yeah, Mrs. Mole wants to see you.
Who is a school psychologist or whatever, so,
yeah,
know, that so, has repercussions, playground repercussions.
Right, and so just the fact that, you know, she sits down with this woman and says, look, next time hire a skywriter, you know,
yeah,
it'll be better for both of us. That kind of thing, it's that thing that lets us know, like you said, why it is that she would reject this person who's reaching out to her, because adults don't remember that kind of dynamic.
Mm-hmm.
They don't remember that it's not cool to be seen with the teacher, or not cool to know that you're going someplace different than everybody else is.
Yeah, especially the school psychologist, you know.
Yeah.
And the other thing that he really nails is just that real quippy, witty attitude that she has. It wasn't too overdone to where you were like, come on. It was just this perfect amount. And it was like, you know, when you think of that perfect comeback later on, you know.
Right.
She's the one that's saying it in the moment, you know.
And then getting her ass handed to her because
sure,
she said it.
Yeah.
So, yeah, again, I think that this was probably one of the best realized characters that I've seen in a while. I mean, this was a fully three-dimensional character, and I enjoyed her tremendously.
Yeah, definitely.
You know, and the plot, too. I mean, like I said, the plot moved along, and it was a great integration of plot and character. that the plot in and of itself is compelling. And like I said, there's kind of multiple plots. You've got, you know, just this girl trying to go through her fifth grade life, which is pretty miserable. So you've got this sort of slice of life story going that's very compelling. Mm-hmm. And then you have the fantasy element thrown in that, again, isn't really clear, but it sure is real to Barbara. Again, that's another compelling plot element. So you've got two very compelling plot elements moving along together at the same time. And I was drawn into both of them.
Yeah, the plot was excellent. I mean, I couldn't have asked for more. And I was really... And that being said, like, this is one of the few mediums or books or anything that has misted me up at the end. And, like, I actually, you know, felt water coming to my eyes and stuff. It, like, touched me that much. I don't get that from movies. I don't get that, you know, from anything else. And rarely does it ever happen to me. And this book really touched me.
Well, and again, it's the quiet moments. It's that caring so much about the character that, yeah, you cheer for them when the good things happen, but you really feel it when the bad things happen.
Yeah.
And so when you get an emotional response from the character, you're so involved with her that you've got that little emotional beat too. And I was with you too at the end there where it all comes together. And it was a really moving moment. And a lot of times writers, they kind of tell the one story they want to tell, and then something else sort of just gets padded in at the end or you get some sort of trite wrap up to this. And for this, like I said, to have two distinct plots going on and to have two satisfying resolutions to the plots, one very loud, one very quiet.
And both hitting with full impact.
Right. It was, you know, you get kind of wrung out at the end, which is what Barbara is, too.
Yeah.
You know, Barbara is completely wrung out at the end. And that's fantastic, too.
Mm-hmm. Very satisfying end, too.
Yes. I really enjoyed the end, which we're not going to spoil.
Yes.
Other than have a hanky. If a 6'4" straight edge punk can get all misty-eyed, you'll need a hanky.
The art was one of the best things about this book. I mean...
Okay, I'm going to disagree wholeheartedly with you.
Really?
Yeah, I am. Go ahead. Lay out your argument for me.
I absolutely loved the art. It was this gentle mix between manga and like a European style, and I absolutely loved it. I loved all of the design of the characters. Each character was distinct. Women looked like women, men looked like men, and all of the scenes were really well laid out.
I liked the human designs. I think the human designs in this were great. And I'll agree with you. Each character was unique, distinct. Whether they were close up or far away, I knew who the people were when they were human. Where I had problems was when we switch from the, you know, human world to this sort of fantasy world that she has, and specifically involving the giants and the titans. That what Nimora does in the art to move them beyond humanity is to stretch and move them, I don't know, back up the evolutionary chain, which he consciously did. And there's notes about it in the back. The back matter was a lot of fun. It really was. There were some great notes about how the characters were designed and developed.
I guess I don't understand what your point is. Did you dislike about
that? I disliked the exaggeration to the point where when you get the big impact moments with the Titans, all of the, I don't know, all points of reference are gone for me, I guess. that it was very difficult for me to follow the action because the Titan was so different.
Yeah, I think that that was the point. It was sort of like this Akira-esque moment where everything else fades away and it's just this battle of this girl and the giant or the Titan, and that's all you see and that's all the point of reference is. And when you come to find out what how the story resolves, I feel like that's kind of the point.
Yeah, I mean, I get
it's hard to argue my point without...
I know, spoiling. We don't want to spoil it. I mean, I'm looking at... Like I said, I'm looking at... excuse me. I'm looking at towards the end here, you know, and specifically some of the panels where you have... Where you get an idea of the just general size of this beast. And so you get very, very large creatures and very small creatures interacting with each other. And a lot of the points of reference of... You know, what one character is doing to another get lost because the character is so exaggerated, is so, you know, long and hairy and bestial. And maybe it's just a preference on my part.
Sure.
What I thought, though, was so cool about the long, and I'll get back to not, I guess that's a character design issue is what I have on it. What I liked, though, was that there were times where the antagonists, the bullies in the real world, were shown in full shading. So they were basically just black shapes against a white background. And they very, very closely resembled the giants and titans as Barbara was describing them. And I thought that was a neat trick that Nomura used to show that, you know, evil comes in many forms.
There's several really great things like that. Like, in the buildup of the story, you start to see when she says that, you know, she feels like evil coming or whatever, you start to see, like, little giant faces, like, in the clouds in the background. And you really get this ominous sense of the how what is coming,
right?
And I think that that's what I liked about the Titan design, is that is a terrifying creature. And I mean, you could see that on like the cover of like a metal band, you know, like it is a terrifying creature, and it really belonged in this story.
Yeah, and I think that, I mean, yes, the Titan was significantly huge. And again, I'm looking at the cover for Chapter 6, the Titan. And I'm looking at that, and the beast is so magnificently huge that, you know, the head is missing from the picture. Which, on the one hand, gives you a sense of the size of the beast, but at the same time, it has multiple mouths. And the mouths are, you know, some of the mouths are on the arms, some are on the, you know, the pectorals. And so when that's the creature that we get, and that's the sort of impact piece of the picture, and we're, you know, the anatomy is so skewed, that's where I was running into problems with it. It wasn't so much with the Titan in particular. It was more just the anatomy of it and how trying to have it interacting with other creatures, you know, it just... And again, I'm a couple of pages later, I'm looking at it up here as it's taking a swipe.
Yeah.
How just the, you know, like I said, the anatomy of it... It is very, you know, anime, manga-esque in its design. But for me, that was the one place where it fell down. Was just the creatures were almost too big to comprehend. But at the same time, I guess that's kind of the point.
Yeah.
Now that I'm saying it out loud.
Yeah, I completely disagree. And I think that that is entirely the point. It's this... completely terrifying thing that how do you get over as a human being, let alone a fifth grade girl.
Right.
How do you comprehend? How do you understand? How do you defeat?
Which works both as an allegory and as a reality piece for this story.
Yeah, definitely.
You know, how there are some things in our real life that how do you get over them? How are they so big? How do you defeat them? And, you know, that's what Barbara is struggling with this.
Sure. So I guess it's probably best to quit while we're ahead on this.
Yeah, you know,
before we
spoil too much.
Yeah.
You know, I think one thing, just the design of the actual book, I actually grabbed this and then put it back because I was worried that mine had like some sticky tape residue or something on it.
Are you talking about like how you see the...
Yeah, and the guy color. At the counter did the same thing. There are little outlines of, I don't know, little nymphs or
fairies
or something. And they're in, they're done in gloss.
Mm-hmm.
So while the book itself gloss. Is matte, the fairies are in gloss. And so you'll catch like a fairy wing or something. And really, it looks just like a sticky tape piece or something. And, you know, once you look at it in the light and move it around, you can kind of see them and find them in different places making weird faces at you, which is kind of fun. And again, goes back to the whole balance between is it real, is it fantasy?
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, if you get a copy, it's not, there's something sticky on it.
Yeah, so how did you feel the value was?
You know, it was $16, which breaks down to what, about $2.30 an issue, which I thought was a pretty good deal. Plus you got the back matter in the back. And like you, this is the kind of book that I want to hand to people and say, here, read this. And I want to hand it to kids.
Yeah.
You know, we went back and forth about Missing the Boat, you and I, a book that was supposed to be for kids. Yeah. And we had a really hard time deciding what age level it would be good for. This one, I mean, I teach middle school in my real life. And this is the kind of book that I would love to have middle school kids read. I would love to have middle school girls read this book.
Yeah.
Even though the character is fifth grade, her vocabulary is definitely not, you know, maybe it is typical fifth grader, but I mean, it's not how fifth graders are typically written. It's the kind of thing that a middle school kid would definitely get behind, even if the character was a little bit younger than them.
Yeah.
And really, for the most part, there's nothing terribly inappropriate in here. There's a couple of mentions about menstruation and puberty and you know, vagina. I mean, that get mentioned, but again, it's not swearing per se. It's
yeah, and I don't feel like it was in a you know, a spurious way or anything like that. It was pertinent to the story or right. the action that was happening. And
it was the way that the characters would have spoken. And it's something that would be real to a, like I said, about a middle school age kid.
And it wasn't salacious.
No, it wasn't. And that's the thing, is that, you know, for parents, you know, one of the hardest things as a parent is to understand that our children know more than we think they do and are in contact with more than we think they are. So really, the you know, few instances of what would be, you know, at all, quote unquote, objectionable are things that the kids are already going to be aware of.
Yeah.
But like you said, I mean, this is such a good book. It rings so true on so many levels, and it works as a fantasy piece. It works as a reality piece. It's a great way to introduce kids to the idea of metaphors and symbolism. You know, this one's definitely getting handed out and passed around.
For sure. Like I said, this is a must-buy. This is the first book this year that I felt that every person that loves comic books has to own
and or people that read. And people that haven't read comics in a while, you know, people that are just saying, you know, hey, you know, what is it, what would I enjoy, what would I like?
Yeah, I agree, this would be a great crossover gift for somebody that maybe doesn't read comics but appreciates literature. I feel like they could still relate to this book. It's just such a well-done comic book.
Right. And it also works, a lot of people, get wrapped up in my kid just reads manga. Here's a great crossover as well for the manga readers, because like you said, there are elements in it that are very similar, that it draws from manga, and so they can find it familiar and cross over to, more mainstream comics, if you will.
And I cannot wait for future Joe Kelly stuff. Like, this is just awesome, and I can't wait to see what he puts out next. And also Ken Niemura. I really liked his art, and so I'll be looking to pick up whatever he does next.
Yeah, definitely people to look out for.
Next up is Resurrection by Mark Guggenheim, David Dumier, and Douglas Dabbs. And so essentially this is a story that is about, I think it was a 23-year-long war with aliens.
10-year.
10-year, was it?
10-year war.
I saw somewhere in here where somebody said maybe they made first contact 23 years ago. Yes, that was kind of confusing.
There has been alien contact for 23 years. Most people weren't aware of it. And then for the last 10 years, there's been open warfare on the planet.
Okay, and so this drops us in like the day after the aliens mysteriously just disappear. And it takes more of a Why the Last Man or Walking Dead approach, where it's just really realistic talking heads. How is human life functioning after this cataclysmic event?
Right, and like Walking Dead, there's very little alien interaction in this. Just like in Walking Dead, there's very little actual zombie interaction. It is all about the human interaction and how society starts to reorganize itself in the face of this apocalypse, really.
Yeah.
So, overall, what did you think just overall on this one?
It left me feeling flat. And one of the problems that I had was there was no real mysteries brought up that I was waiting to resolve in the next volume. I felt like these events moved along slowly. Nothing really happened. No mysteries were brought up into why you want to know what is happening or what is going to happen. There was no drama put into any of that. And that is one of the main reasons why I left it feeling flat.
Yeah, I mean, going back to Why the Last Man, because I really feel like that's the closest comparison that we have in this. One of the driving points in Why the Last Man was, while the men died. I mean, that was really one of the driving points. The next one was, why was Yorick left alive? And then the third one was really, was he going to get back with Beth?
Yeah.
I mean, was he going to find Beth? Was she even alive? And was he going to get back with her? With this, it starts out almost as, why did the aliens all of a sudden leave? But then it gets dropped.
Yeah, it's never brought up again. And it's almost like it's a point that's not gonna be filled in or isn't necessary, and I feel like that should be the driving force that keeps you wanting to come back. And not only that, but building drama with events that just wasn't done here.
And you got a lot of trying to build something to hold on to. There's the feeling that Tully was somehow responsible for what happened, but we're not sure which the what happened was that we're talking about.
Yeah.
There's flashbacks in this, so we know that he's somehow involved in a high-level political act.
That's what they really needed. They really needed a main actor in this book that was behind some sort of nefarious events that caused them to attack us. If we had been... I mean, they had raised already the thought that, you know, why after 23 years, why after 13 years did they attack us?
Right.
But it that point was never hammered on, and there was no drama built around any of that. And that's where I left it feeling flat. Like, give me something to wonder about and to want to hold on to.
Right. Give me a plot point to follow.
Yeah.
And even then, the migration of the characters was not a compelling plot point either.
Yeah, really wasn't. None of the character interaction, which is what this book is really trying to draw you in with, none of that was compelling in any way. There was no drama buildup really at all between any of the character interactions, and you just sort of felt like things were just resolved, like building up slightly, resolving, building up slightly, resolving, but they weren't building enough to develop any real drama.
And that was the hard part too, was I didn't know who to follow in this. There were, you know, with Why the Last Man, you had Yorick, you had, you know, Agent 355, and you had the Doctor.
Yeah.
And really, those were our three characters.
And a clear protagonist, Yorick. We're following Yorick throughout the whole thing.
Right. And with The Walking Dead, you get the sheriff and, you know, his family. And yes, there's sort of a wide number of supporting cast, but really we see it through the sheriff, through the whole thing. With Resurrection, we're introduced early on to Sarah and Ben. And we kind of get the feeling that, okay, Sarah and Ben are going to be who we follow through this. But then Sarah and Ben come into contact with Simon. And so, okay, now we got Sarah, Ben, and Simon. But Simon leads them off to go talk to Tully. Well, Tully's involved with, you know, all these other people. And all
meanwhile,
of a sudden,
we're flashing to Judith, and she's got one of the aliens captured, back and forth. And nothing ever happens with that. Nothing happens with that, like, whatsoever. And I was just like, why are you building all of this for nothing really to happen?
And it was, yeah, it became, instead of being a rich tapestry of characters that I wanted to be engaged with, there was never enough, like you said, interaction between characters. There was never enough about particular characters to make me care about any of them.
There was no development.
No.
You don't know, you don't have a sense who's good acting in this drama, who's bad, and what are their qualifications or anything. We have no idea of any of that.
The only character who I walked out of being more interested in was at the very end, Judith. And it took until the last chapter.
Special chapter at the end.
Right, the special chapter at the end that had been an annual or something, or a special, yeah, the 2007 annual. That really sort of filled in some gaps from an earlier chapter. She became a lot more interesting all of a sudden.
Yeah.
But other than that, the character development just wasn't there. It was like they were trying to create almost heroes in the sense of, let's get as many characters as we can here and hope that something sticks.
Mm-hmm.
And it just didn't work. There wasn't anybody that was compelling. They kept trying to, like I said, they tried to make it so that Tully was somehow responsible for all of this, and they tried to make it so that, you know, Paul, who is sort of the acting president of the United States, was somehow involved in all of this. But again,
he came out somehow nefarious, but really that wasn't hammered on. So you almost felt like when Ben and him got together, they had some sort of friction between them, but you had no sense, is Ben a good person? He hadn't done any real good deeds up until this point.
No.
Is Paul a good person? He hadn't done anything particularly bad. Like, they tried to build him as a nefarious character by killing somebody, but that person tried to kill him first.
Yeah.
Like, really, I had no sense about who was.
And then when they finally did try to make Paul be really, you know, tried to make him be the bad guy, it was so over the top bad. I mean, all he needed was a cape and a mad plan. I mean, They literally have him saying they need someone to make the trains run on time.
Yeah.
I mean, you really can't get any more over the top with that. Having a character say that straight-laced without, you know, giving him a monocle and a, you know, a cape and a nefarious plan. I mean, really, it's...
Is this guy Joseph Stalin all yeah, of a I mean, sudden, you know, like...
Little Mussolini nothing, thrown in and
nothing
yeah.
matters as long as I'm controlling anything.
Yeah, it was just a... I don't know. People being... I mean, I think that part of what Guggenheim was probably going for was that the, you know, in this post-apocalyptic world, all the old rules of society are gone, and people will go through extreme lengths to try to make the world the way it was. And he shows it in such over-the-top ways. When we find the president, or acting president, the first time we see him, he's walking down this very idealized Main Street USA. And then it's revealed that these are all, you know, Hollywood facades. I mean, literally, they're just props. They're propped up. There's nothing behind them. And then we see him later on in the book, and he's in the Oval Office. And it's revealed that the Oval Office is nothing but a set. And it's eventually revealed that they're living inside a mountain.
Yeah, in like a bunker.
Yeah, in a bunker. And so why even bother to create Main Street USA and a set of the Oval Office, going out of your way to make something idealized that wasn't even there? And again, it was never explained. I mean, it would make sense if, you know, it was somehow explained that they were trying to create propaganda and trying to, you know, film this and let the populace know that, you know, everything's all right. But that was never explained. That was never shown.
Yeah.
It was really that...
almost seemed as if there was no power left anymore anywhere. I mean, it made it seem like everything had just broken down. Yeah.
And it was almost like he was just some rich guy living in fantasy land. I mean, it was almost like he was Michael Jackson. I mean, really, he'd created his own little fantasy world there, and his fantasy world was where everything was just okay, and everyone was kind of playing along with him.
Yeah, I really didn't get the focus of this book. There really was none, and that's what it really needed, was a direct focus where all of these actors are working towards.
And it was a brilliant setup.
Yeah, it really was.
That was the problem. It was a brilliant setup. It was, and then what happened?
Yeah.
I mean, really, it takes place after the story happens, and then what? Fear Agent does a great job with that.
Yeah.
You know, Fear Agent is based on after the big intergalactic war, and then what happens?
Uh-huh.
Same kind of deal. After the alien apocalypse, then what happens? You try to rebuild society. There's a compelling storyline.
Yes.
And you're living in fear of these creatures coming back.
Yes.
There's a compelling storyline. But it was...
There's one left on the planet that's been there for 23 years that's developed some sort of working relationship with a CIA agent. That's a compelling story as well, like understanding that. But none of this has seemed to any fruition.
No, not at all. And again, you know, people just act in ways that I, you know, don't make any sense to me whatsoever. I mean, if Barbara in I Killed Giants was, you know, such a fully realized character that, you know, she could mouth off to someone and I could totally understand it, why there wasn't a single character in this story that I felt like I understand what it is they're talking about and why they're saying it.
I have no idea what their motivations are.
No. No. And, you know, and the guy who, you know, Tully, who, when we first see Tully, he's trapped in some sort of goo. And
that was another one. Like, there's all this, like, this build up towards that, and then, it's all released. He escapes it, and everything's fine.
And, you know, he makes this glib comment about, I have an IQ of 238, so I'm going to use big words. You know, I don't have an IQ anywhere near 238, and I understood everything he was talking about. It's not like he was such a brilliant, great guy. Yeah. You know?
I totally agree. I hated that character.
Yeah, and that's the thing. And again, I'm not sure. Are we supposed to hate the character? Because if we're supposed to hate the character, then why is it that the character I think we're supposed to like, Sarah, ends up siding with him later on in the story?
Yeah, I have no idea. And to make it even worse, I really don't care.
No, I really don't either. And, you know, what I think is interesting is that I had a really hard time getting a hold of this book. You and I actually wanted to review this book several weeks ago.
Yeah, totally.
And it took forever for me to find a copy of it.
Yeah, I had to get a second shipment
and then
at my local comic book shop.
On Free Comic Book Day, there was a Zero issue released for the new series of this. There's actually now a new series of this. And that was, I mean, I got one of the last copies of that.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, so clearly there's a lot of buzz built up around this, and so having all that buzz built up around it, I was going into this with such high hopes. Again, like I said, you know, I love, you know, Why the Last Man. I love Walking Dead.
I love sci-fi. I was really excited for this book, and there was just nothing there. And the art, I felt like nobody was acting in this. Facial expressions were the same throughout, and there is no sense of motion between panels. It was very static images of people posing throughout this. I didn't feel a sense of motion. I didn't feel that anybody was making really different faces from what they normally made. And so I wasn't really impressed with the art.
No, there were, yeah, I agree. And you know, the art went from bad to worse because the bonus chapter at the end, the art was just awful.
Yeah.
Spock, the alien, went from looking very creature-like in the previous six chapters to almost, you know, robotic.
Yeah.
In this final chapter. And I didn't like that. And you know, and the inking was just, you know, big, great big blocks of black in there. One of the other problems that I had, though, in the first six chapters was, you know, there were a few scenes, there were a few images that I thought were quite good. You know, chapter four, the double page spread of the alien ship hovering over the White House. I thought that was a pretty cool image. Most of the things I enjoyed were revolved around the alien technology. The giant ship, when we see it for the first time, again, a massive double page spread.
The problem with the art, though, is that this is a talking heads book.
Right.
That's about dialogue and human interactions, and there's no emotions being emoted from these people, and it's very jumpy, staticky kind mm-hmm. of art.
And then, even then, you know, the stuff that I was just saying I liked, you know, the big sort of the scenery things, there are some times where there's supposed to be an impact, and I don't get it. You know, at the start of chapter six, we see the wreckage that is Washington, D.C. And, you know, I get the wreckage of Washington, D.C. It's kind of how I would expect Washington, D.C. to look if no one had lived there for 10 years and it had been bombed out. It's bombed out, it's overgrown, there's a lot wrong with it. A few pages later, excuse me, a few pages later, there is a shot of a Learjet flying over London. I can't tell what the impact is supposed to be there. Is this supposed to be London flooded? Because yeah, there's so much black. Is this supposed to be...
That's what I was confused about as well.
London untouched because, you know, the towers are still there and are, you know, intact? You know, there. I was really left not understanding what the impact of the page is supposed to be. And it was a plot point.
Yeah, I mean, I totally agree with that. I didn't I assumed that it was flooded. That's what I took out of it. I don't know if that was correct, because why would they be going there if it's flooded?
Yeah, or... but it says London. Why London? It says take a look out the window, and Judith says Christ, and then you turn the page. It's a double page spread of what is supposed to be London. Yeah. And I don't get it. I mean, I don't.
That's pretty much the last we see of them, isn't it?
Until we get the bonus chapter where we get a flashback to Judith.
But, I mean, from that time,
point
forward. So it isn't even explained to us.
No. No, it isn't.
So maybe if that would have been explained to me, I would maybe have something to grasp a hold of, you know?
But yeah.
There was absolutely nothing.
Yeah, is there some sort of conspiracy that London was left untouched while the rest of the world wasn't? Or
that it was flooded?
Flooded. What is it?
I don't get it.
The book ends with Simon returning to the massive ship. And it took me a while to figure out it was Simon, because the art is not stellar.
Yeah.
Simon returning to the ship and communicating with the aliens, and saying that he needs their help. And I think that's supposed to be the cliffhanger for the story, is that, you know, the aliens have left.
Yeah, because something happened to him
Simon
in that ship.
Right.
And so, where he got scrambled or something, supposedly.
Yeah, it's almost got that Stephen King, the Tommyknockers feeling to it, where there's an... warning to anybody who hasn't read the Tommyknockers and cares. There's an alien ship that lands, and as it slowly is uncovered or unearthed, it affects all the people around them.
Yeah. I think it's okay to spoil that 30-year-old
30-year-old Stephen King book. But okay, hey... you know, Jake didn't know. We have a special studio guest tonight, and so Jake didn't know the ending to the Tommyknockers. Sorry, Jake, your Stephen King is ruined for the night.
That's okay.
But, you know, it's kind of that idea where something is scrambled, something's happened to him, and now he's in communication with them. I don't know if that means that that's supposed to be the setup for why they're coming back. Again, if that could have been built up better, if that piece... would have been introduced earlier to add a little more tension to the story, and again to repeat the idea that they're gone, we don't know why they're gone, and oh god, what do we do if they come back? Yeah. But that was never done. It was, yeah, they're gone, it worked, whatever the it was, this longbow thing, which was referred to, whatever, yeah, this longbow thing was, worked. Great. It worked. Why? What? What? What's the deal with the devil? Why? You know, why do we care? And I don't.
Yeah.
Other
than that, the value for it was...
You know, at $6, I mean, that's a pretty good value. I would have paid $9.99 for this. You know, yeah, at $9.99...
Especially with the buzz built up around it. For $6, I mean, that was really a smoking deal.
You know, $6, a good premise... bad execution.
So there was, what, like 7 issues with that annual?
Yeah.
Included? I mean, that's less than $1 an issue, really.
Right. And like I said, I mean, once we got, you know, the chapter 7, even though the story was, I mean, the art was horrible, and that was a different artist. That, I believe, was the Douglas Dabbs. When the story actually... was a lot better. And I think that it kind of, you know, throughout this story, you know, overall, there were lots of flashbacks as we kind of understood how people fit into the overall tapestry. But
there was no cleverness with that,
right,
interweaving at all. Whereas, like, with Why the Last Man or Walking Dead, you know, there's some cleverness with how all of that comes together. There was none of that with this.
Yeah, the chapter 7, I thought, was the one time where there was a little bit.
Yeah.
Where we saw a scene that we were familiar with happening from a different perspective.
Yeah,
and it added a lot to it. Whereas the other scenes hadn't added much to it. Hadn't, you know, it didn't really matter much you know, that these people were, you know, where they were 10 years before or whatever. But with this, the chapter 7 in particular, it served to drive home a lot of points that, you know, I think could have been made a lot better throughout the book.
Definitely. So, all that being said, would you pick up the next trade?
I don't know.
If it's at, like, the $10 price point, would you?
I really don't know, because I haven't read the Zero issue yet. It's got a different artist attached to it. You know, and one of my big beefs, you know, like, he was with the art. It's in color, which the new series is going to be in color, which will also hopefully help to you know,
illuminate between flooding.
Between flooding and devastation and, you know, happily paved streets.
Sure.
The premise is strong enough that if it was, a $9.99 price point, I would take another shot at it. I would.
I can say I will not buy this if it's any more than $6. If it's another $6 trade, I can pick it up. But as it sits right now, I am completely uninterested with this book. I feel like Mark Guggenheim is not a comic book writer. And I don't want to read any further work of his.
See,
unless it's for cheap.
I have to, you know, I have to trust in the premise that it's capable of telling. There are good stories to be told with it. And clearly we've seen that there are good stories to be told with it. Like I said, I mean, we keep going back to Why the Last Man. We keep going back to The Walking Dead, which are basically the same premise, just told in a slightly different story. So I have to believe that there's good stories to be told.
I don't feel like this guy's getting it done. And I don't have any faith in the writer, and I'm dropping it.
Yeah, like I said, if it's more than about $9.99, it's not coming home with me. Yeah. We'll see. Like I said, I'll read the Zero issue. It was free, which is, you know, a great price. And, you know, like I said, if there's something compelling to it, I'll give it a shot. But again, it's not starting for me at the same level that this trade was. This trade was starting at a high level for me. I was excited about it. Like I said, I went back to the shop. I asked for it. I tried to find it. I'm not going to go out of my way to find the next one. I'm not going to, you know, get it day of release. You know, again, if it's $9.99, maybe, you know, I might pick it up used someplace. You know, hit the comic book shows and find it in a half price bin or something.
And maybe, if I'm really bored, I might borrow yours.
Well, you'll need something to read once, you know, you've handed out your I Kill Giants.
You've been listening to Stumptown Trade Review, your online resource for independent trades. And you can find us on the web at www.stumptowntradereview.com. You've gone the new way of thinking. I call it regrets, it's ignorance.